Hi everyone, welcome to the Genomics Lab podcast, the podcast about current research in the field of genomics. I'm your host, Olivia Grant, a PhD candidate at the University of Essex and Queen Mary University of London. Join me as I speak to researchers in the field of genomics about their current research, their latest papers, and what they're up to in the lab. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode and make sure that you subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast platform. And without further ado, let's get into today's episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to a brand new episode of the Genomics Lab. So today's episode, I am talking to the wonderful Dr. Christopher Todd from the Babraham Institute, who is soon moving to be part of Altos Labs, which is very exciting. So this conversation I recorded a couple of months ago. So first of all, I have to say my biggest apologies to Chris for taking literally months to put this episode out. But as I keep saying, final year is tough. So yeah, but I'm so excited to finally be sharing it with you and listening back. Oh my God, just remembered how cool Chris is and also how cool his research is. So if you listen to the podcast, you've definitely heard me talking about, well, you've like in the past, you heard me talking about Greeks, which is the conference that I organized with, as part of Queen Mary, with Dovetail Genomics, with three of my colleagues, which was so much fun. And basically Chris was talking at the conference, and as I was listening to him talk, I was like, right, I need to get him on my podcast. Because yeah, his talk was awesome and he was such a good speaker. And Fran, who I also organized the conference with, who is amazing as well. And actually I should get on the podcast, but I have a feeling Fran would say no to me because I don't know, he's probably fed up of me. But Fran did say to me before that Chris was an amazing speaker and he was not wrong. So yes, literally behind the scenes, like on the Zoom chat, I literally messaged him. I was like, do you want to come on the podcast? I didn't think he was going to say yes, but he did. So very happy. It was amazing. Such a great chat. So I hope you all enjoy it and learn a lot about transposable elements and, like me, hopefully realize how cool they are. So I hope you enjoy. And next week, I'm off to a conference in Edinburgh, which will be my first in-person conference. And it'll be my first time presenting a poster, like in person, which I am excited for. It'll also be the first time that I see my supervisor give a in-person talk, which again, I'm very excited for. And obviously I'm excited to see people from the lab and my supervisor in person after like 2 years, well, nearly 3 years really. So yes, by the time when you are listening to this, if you listen to it on the day it gets released, which I know some of you do, I will be in a conference listening to some fun talks. So yes, hope you enjoy it. And I will see you for next month's episode where we're talking about daffodil genomes, which is exciting. I have some guests lined up as well, but if you are interested in talking to me, do shoot me an email, olivia.grant@essex.ac.uk, or send me a DM on Twitter, which is olivia_a_grant. But without further ado, hope you enjoy the episode and learn a lot about transposable elements and epigenetic priming of enhancers with Chris. Welcome everyone to episode 2 of 2022. I feel so happy to be like back filming, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Christopher Todd. We're going to go with Chris, from the Babraham Institute. I have mentioned a couple times in the introductions. I don't know if anyone actually listens to the introductions or if people just skip over me rambling and go straight to the conversations with the exciting people, but I have mentioned in the introductions for the episodes for a while about Greeks 2022. So this was the gene regulation and epigenetics conference for early career scientists, and we were lucky enough to have Chris present. And literally as I was watching Chris's talk, I was like, I need to get him on the podcast. And I literally messaged him on the Zoom chat behind the scenes like, do you want to come on the podcast? So welcome Chris to the podcast.
It was 2 minutes after I finished the talk and I was already reading in chat, oh, invitation for podcast. I was like, oh, that's an exciting opportunity.
Yeah, I was like, is he gonna say yes or I don't know.
I mean, you had been plugging the podcast at the previous session, talking about some really cool ways of doing outreach, and yeah, the podcast is a great way of doing that.
Absolutely. I plug it everywhere I can, to be honest.
But yeah, no, I'm so happy that you've joined me. I appreciate it and I appreciate your time. Let's start with an introduction as to, can you just introduce yourself, who you are, what you do?
So I did my undergraduate degree in biology at the University of York, probably a shocking amount of years ago now. And during
can we
that,
how many years? Can we disclose how many years?
So I was at York
you don't have to.
from 2012.
Oh my gosh.
Actually, no, that's sooner than that. It was, I think it's so long ago, I've like genuinely kind of starting to forget the years. So yeah, I was there from 2009 to 2013. And it was a 3-year biology degree. But I also spent a year doing Erasmus. I spent actually a year in a placement at the Max Planck Institute in Dresden, where I kind of got my first introductions into getting really excited about developmental biology and developmental genetics. So I did that placement with Pavel Tomichak's lab, where we do some really cool evolutionary developmental biology with Drosophila. I then failed to get onto a PhD course the first year I applied, so I ended up working as a research assistant at the Genomics Core at the Medical Research Council Institute in Hammersmith. I then did manage to finally get a PhD place in Miguel Branco's brand new lab at Queen Mary University of London. So I managed to join the really up and coming and exciting epigenetics hub that was being built there. And Miguel got me really excited about retrotransposons. And so I did a PhD project there looking at the role retrotransposons play in early mammalian development, potentially acting as functional enhancers. I still remain very interested in early mammalian development and like regulation of the gene networks within. And so I pursued a postdoctoral position with Wolf Reich's lab, who are using some really cool single-cell multi-omic approaches to investigate early mammalian development. And so I did my first 3 years of postdoc with Wolf's lab looking at lineage priming and the epigenetic priming of enhancer elements during early human development, particularly in priming of early human brain tissues. I also spent a brief little period volunteering at the COVID-19 Lighthouse Labs during the first wave of the pandemic, which is an interesting experience. And later this year, I will be joining the brand new Altos Labs, which is a new biotech company looking at using cellular rejuvenation and helping improve cell health to try and help treat various diseases.
So exciting. I feel like you've literally just done so many exciting things. When I listen to people like you, I'm just like...
It's one of those career paths where you don't necessarily have a very smooth run. But it has been fascinating in like constantly pursuing things which interest me.
Constantly exciting and like new things, you know. I nearly did a placement year like at uni, but I decided like last minute to change and I kind of regret it, but I also don't regret it because I feel like, you know, if I did change then maybe I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today. So no regrets and all that. But
I mean, for me, it was a great way of learning that I really loved research biology and actually being in lab and pursuing research questions in an experimental way. And that's kind of was my first thing of this is the career I want to pursue, is actually being in lab, doing experiments, learning about science.
Yeah, exactly. And I still had that moment as well, because like I did my like final year project, my undergraduate project in Dr. Brad Uzebet's lab, who's now also at Queen Mary in the Epi Hub. But like I hadn't ever done like a bioinformatics module, and I was like, I always thought like I do love biology, but I don't think I'll be a scientist because I don't enjoy like being in the lab. But that was the moment where I was like, this is what I want to do, this is what I love, and I just had the best time ever. And yeah, so I can relate to that feeling of just like knowing like this is what I need to pursue, you know.
I mean, bioinformatics is also incredibly exciting when you start using it, and the power and the way you can delve into research questions. It's great fun. And I highly recommend anyone who's currently learning biology to consider also learning bioinformatics and coding. It is a fantastically powerful tool to use in addition to wet lab.
Absolutely. So that kind of leads me on to my next question, which I guess you kind of answered, but I was going to say, like, what's your split at the moment, like currently, or just like overall, how would you explain, like, are you a wet lab scientist, are you dry lab, are you mixed? Like, how would you explain yourself?
I would say I was trained as a wet lab biologist. I still feel very much like a caveman learning to use tools for the first time when I do bioinformatics. However, most of my authorships come from bioinformatic analyses I've done. So it feels like I might be more of a bioinformatician than I am a wet lab. But I think the split depends differently as to the project. I rely quite heavily on bioinformatics to keep projects going, as I do a lot of tech development and a lot of projects which take a long time to lead up to the actual experimental data. So there's a lot of time for bioinformatics to plug in those gaps while I'm spending a lot of time in lab just working on technologies. So I would say a lot of my data and my results and kind of my insights into the research questions I do come from bioinformatics, but it only takes up, say, about 30% of my time.
Yeah, and what do you prefer? What, like, if you had to be one or the other, what would you pick?
I can't say I like to choose, because I think having the mix...
You have to choose. Like, I'm forcing you to choose.
Oh, you've forced me to choose. What can you go with? Okay. I think bioinformatics does cinch it.
Yeah. Good
choice.
But
only just.
Good
getting
choice.
In the lab, doing CRISPR technologies to like really interrogate the systems I find interesting that identify with bioinformatics. That is still a major passion of mine and something I'm looking forward to keep doing as my career goes.
Okay, well, the good news is that, you know, you don't actually have to choose in real life, just on the podcast. Okay, cool. So I am interested then, let's talk a little bit more about the work that you did during your PhD. So you've mentioned retrotransposons. Maybe we should start. Can you explain what is a retrotransposon for anyone who's not heard of this term before?
So retrotransposons, and like the broader term transposons or transposable elements, are what we call mobile repetitive DNA sequences, by which we mean that they're able to jump around the genome. And they do this by generating a copy of the sequence and then inserting that copy elsewhere back into the genome, leaving you with lots of repeats of the same DNA sequence. And then these are subdivided based on the molecular transposition intermediate. So you have retrotransposons, which mobilize by an RNA intermediate, hence the name retro. And then you have the DNA transposons, which mobilize via just a DNA intermediate. And they are believed to kind of, at least a lot of them, derived from ancient viruses, which insert themselves into the genome and then lost their ability to generate viral particles, but still remained within the genome and retained that capacity to replicate their own DNA and insert that copy back into the genome. And they're very good at invading the host genome. They make up about a third of the Drosophila genome, and actually almost a half, or even potentially more, up to like 65% of our own genomes. And so that's a considerable proportion of our DNA is made up of these potentially selfish, like, genomic weeds, which are just there replicating.
It's just crazy. Like, I remember, like, when I first, like, learned about this, I was like, what? Like, I just find it weird that, like, not a lot of people know this, because I feel like it's such an interesting fact, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when they were first identified, well, they weren't necessarily identified for a long time when the human genome was sequenced, and we identified that only 2% were encoding for proteins. A lot of the rest of it just got considered junk DNA and unimportant. And then when they were identified, they were later kind of identified as potentially just selfish DNA elements which are just only invested in their own replication. But as we study them even more, then we're identifying some really interesting kind of effects they can have. And they can potentially play some really important roles in the genome and help actually us perform some of the things we need our genome to do, such as regulate the turning on and activation of gene networks at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so cool. I have a question, which I'm not even going to lie to you, I actually don't know the answer to. What is the difference between transposable elements and retrotransposons? Are the terms used interchangeably? Or
They are a little bit. Retrotransposons are transposons exclusively which repeat by an RNA intermediate.
Right.
So it's like an umbrella term is transposons, and then retrotransposons are a subgroup of that. And the vast majority of the transposable elements found in the human genome are retrotransposons. Only around 2% of our DNA is made up of DNA transposons, which means that the rest of like the other 45% is retrotransposons.
So when we say like transposable elements, we're referring to DNA transposons and retrotransposons.
Yes.
So, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Okay. So interesting. So my first question, I guess, is, and you have to forgive me, I actually don't know much about retrotransposons, anything about this, to be honest. So do we know like how they actually, like how much is actually known about like how they actually jump around, if that makes sense? So do we actually know how they actually like move around the genome?
So it can vary depending on the actual element we're talking about. So there's subcategories and different families of transposons.
Mm-hmm.
One of the bigger groups in the human genome are the line one transposons.
Mm-hmm.
And they contain two sets of genes, an open reading frame one and open reading frame two. The way they get transposed within genome is they express the entire transposon as mRNA. This mRNA is shuttled out into the cytoplasm, and then the two proteins are generated from that mRNA, the ORF1 and the ORF2. Now, they then complex with the RNA itself to make a RNP. It's pronounced that again. It's a ribonucleic protein, I believe it's called, or complex. Ribonucleoprotein is the name for it, sorry. And this then gets shuttled back into the nucleus, and the ORF2 protein has two different domains, one which is an endonuclease, and that nicks the DNA of the host genome. And then it has also a reverse transcriptase, which then converts that mRNA back into DNA, which is then inserted into that nicked region. Now, that last step is kind of still a little unknown, but it's that's how line ones are able to replicate themselves. Now, various other families of transposons don't actually have the capacity for transposing by themselves. So a lot of ALU or SVA elements rely on the ORF2 proteins from line ones to actually be able to jump transpose into the genome. So they rely on other transposon proteins to be able to insert themselves. So they're piggybacking off the system.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah, there's a lot of interplay between different groups of transposons, and some transposons are actually predisposed to inserting into other transposons. So it's a case of there is also maybe some jostling for position in the genome.
Mm-hmm. So how do people, I guess, like know that there were like different families? Like what's actually different between the two like families other than like, is it just like how they jump around the genome that's different, or is there anything else different about them?
So normally it's the structural content of the transposon which then helps decide which type of transposon you are. So like LTR retrotransposons have these long terminal repeats which gives them their name, and that mostly kind of the endogenous retroviral family within that look most like old viral genomes. They have GAGPOL and sometimes M proteins still there in between these two long terminal repeats. However, also those long terminal repeats have a habit of recombining, and you're just left with a solo LTR region. So that's like one way in which we delineate between those two groups. The line ones, again, they look very different. They have this 5' UTR, then the two ORF proteins. And then, yeah, it's really kind of a case of looking at the structural assembly of the transposon. But as the genome mutates and as these transposons mutate, they can kind of then get harder and harder to identify. And so it's often easier to identify young transposable elements, which have been recently introduced to the genome, because they are the most similar to each other. Whereas as they get older and more degraded, it can be harder and harder to identify them. And that's why the estimates for how much of our genome is made up of transposons is hard to pin down, because it can be hard to identify those really old, ancient bits of transposon DNA.
So when you say like old and young, are you referring to like, are we talking like in evolutionary terms?
Yes, we are talking millions of years. And you can often identify species-specific transposons, and that's normally how you can identify roughly how old they are by seeing how far back in the evolutionary tree you stop seeing them.
Oh, okay. So, like, for example, like, are there like shared, like, families or types of transposable elements across species then?
Yeah. So there are obviously like a primate specific subclass. We also then have human specific ones. A lot of the ones I worked with in my PhD were looking at mouse specific ones, which had only been introduced to the species after the divergence from the rat species, the rat clade of the environmental tree. So yeah, you're really looking at like millions and millions of years between these kind of transposition events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And then like, so coming on like a little bit more, I guess, like onto the function of them. So for example, if we have like a shared transposable element, like, I don't know if I should be using the term transposable element or retrotransposon.
if you say transposon, you umbrella all the groups.
Okay, that's exactly what I want to do. So I'm going to say transposon. And you've already taught me that, so I don't know why I'm questioning it. So the listeners are probably like, for God's sake.
You can cut this up.
I'll just leave it in, it's fine. I think everyone, like anyone who listens just knows now, like I just say some stupid things sometimes, and that's fine. Okay, so if we're looking at transposons across species, are the functions then, okay, number one, like how much do we actually know about the functions? So is this a silly question? But I'm wondering, like, are the functions the same across species?
So, I mean, this is a very big question. And
if I ask like a question that's like not well known.
When we say functions of transposons, that is a very broad kind of term to be using in the first place. We could talk about what the transposon is wanting to do, which is just replicate and propagate itself.
Maybe then should I use the term like implications of, okay, I'll let you finish.
Well, talking. I mean, we continue. We continue this, the idea of a function of a transposon. We can also look at potential instances where transposons have been utilized by its host genome to fulfill a function. Okay. For example, some transposons, although they've lost their ability to replicate within the genome, they still hang around for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But why? And so sometimes it's a case of the genome actually benefits from having that transposon there because it's fulfilling a function for the genome, acting as a regulatory element. So this was a lot of what I was working on my PhD, which is, we've identified that some classes of retrotransposons, or transposable elements, depending on how you want to call them, are appearing to be enriched for transcription factor binding.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if you look at, for example, pluripotent stem cell transcription factors, OCT4, SOX2, and NANOG.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at those triple bound sites, you find an over-enrichment for specific LTR elements in mouse.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the theory, that these transposable elements have been co-opted by the host genome to act as functional enhancers to drive expression of nearby genes, specifically within the pluripotent stem cell.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like these were relatively new transposons. They had arrived relatively recently in the mouse populations. When I say relatively recent, I still mean millions of years ago, but after they diverged from the rat clade. And it appears the case of that they'd provided new enhancers for the mouse genome to potentially play a role in regulating nearby genes to upregulate those specific genes in the mouse species.
Mm-hmm.
And it's then potentially that transposons could be acting as a way of introducing new enhancers and driving potentially new gene expression patterns in different species. And so you are potentially looking at then transposons having an expansion across the genome. You end up with suddenly hundreds of copies of these sites. And then those which are beneficial are potentially then maintained and held onto by the genome. And because you've potentially got then lots of the same transcription factor binding sites, they then act as a built-in mechanism for simultaneous and coordinated regulation of lots of different genes at the same time. And there potentially is a built-in mechanism for introducing new motifs at sites which are then useful for that genome.
That's really interesting. I've like not heard of that before.
I mean, if you think about transcription factor motifs, they can be kind of hard to just randomly spontaneously mutate into the genome. So how else are you supposed to introduce that motif where you need it to act, to generate a new enhancer? Mm-hmm. How else does an enhancer kind of come about?
Mm-hmm.
And so transposons are potentially a really quick and easy way of making a coordinated regulatory network across the genome.
Yeah, I guess I've just like never really thought about like where do enhancers come from, I guess. So maybe like, do you mind just like saying like what exactly is an enhancer? Like I've done an episode on it before, but maybe just in case someone who hasn't listened to that, like when we say the word enhancer, what are we talking about?
I mean, I actually sorry. Got asked this
every
in
time,
my
yeah,
thesis.
Every time.
No, it's a big question. It's an important one. And
every
for me,
time I've asked someone this question, I've got that exact face, like that exact response, like just the laugh says it all. But
for me, an enhancer can be defined by its function in increasing or promoting transcription of an associated promoter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the more we learn and investigate enhancers, the more we realize there's no necessary one canonical idea for what an enhancer looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of the most common identity for an enhancer is lots of cooperative transcription factor binding,
mm-hmm.
Which then helps recruit an active histone modifications, H3K27 acetylation, H3K4 monomethylation, and then also RNA polymerase 2, which can then potentially be shuffled onto the promoter to help upregulate the expression of that gene.
Mm-hmm.
However, as we do more investigation, we also identify that there's other potential histone modifications which can be there. We also are identifying a kind of that you might not necessarily need the transcription factor binding. And also maybe you can act as an enhancer merely by promoting the right kind of connections between promoters.
Mm-hmm.
What an enhancer is kind of a big question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But these transposons are potentially acting as enhancers by having those multiple transcription factor binding motifs.
And so then like, is it not weird then to say like that transposable elements are acting as enhancers? Because like then what actually is an enhancer? Like what really is the difference between an enhancer and a transposable element? Is it just that not all transposable elements have the ability to act as enhancers?
I think that's the case. I think it's really a case of, for the transposon, it wants to escape inactive chromatin states. It wants to promote its own transcription into an RNA when it was a functional transposon.
Yeah.
So, for example, LTR transposons, the LTR contains the promoter site for when it was a viral element, when it was trying to increase its own expression.
Yeah.
And that promoter site contains the same kind of cocktail of motifs binding sites as an enhancer may. Mm-hmm. So if you stop it from acting as a promoter by not having it in the right kind of context, it can then be almost pre-made to become an enhancer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it's already recruiting those active transcriptional machineries, the active epigenetic signatures. But it is just a case of, is that really just a side effect of the transposons trying to recruit their own transcription machinery to them?
Mm-hmm.
And it just is a happy coincidence that they also work as really good enhancers for the genome.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's a case of, in my PhD, we did a lot of work to try and get functional information as to whether these guys were acting as true enhancers.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of work with CRISPR to both knock out the actual transposons and also to recruit repressive histone modifications to them with CRISPR-I.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that although we found some cases where some were acting as enhancers, where we saw a big difference in the transcription of associated genes, we also found many instances where we would knock out the transposon or knock it down with CRISPR-I and we saw no impact on the associated gene. So it can be hard to tell the difference between what is actually a functional enhancer or what's something that just looks like an enhancer. However, that being said, it can get even more complicated when you start thinking about the fact that the genome is not just one linear piece of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
It's folding in 3D conformational shapes, And a promoter may have physical interactions or proximity to multiple different enhancers. And if you remove one, maybe a different enhancer steps in, and that's enhancer redundancy, which can be a whole other mess when we try and interrogate enhancers in terms of the functions and the actual definition of whether that enhancer is a true enhancer or just appears to be one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've done I've had some in-depth conversations actually about this topic with, so if anyone's interested in more about this topic, I did one with Sudarshan Pingley and also one with Wendy Bickmore. So we talked about this and it was really, really interesting. Can I just go back a little bit?
Yep.
Sorry. So I had a question, which is, I'm just thinking about this in terms of evolution as well, which I know is not your main interest, but I just want to get your thoughts on it anyway. Probably a naive question. Does genome size correlate with quantity of transposable elements?
Oh, that is a good question. I'm not sure it does. It can definitely be a contributing factor, but we also see some compact genomes which don't have anywhere near as non-coding sequence as human genome, but they still have transposons and quite a hefty percentage. Yeah. It's just a case of then in those instances, transposons need to be extra selective as to where they can transpose into, because otherwise they have a higher instance of disrupting protein coding domains.
Yeah. So then another interesting question, does the amount of transposable elements in a genome correlate with complexity of the organism?
I don't think it necessarily does.
No?
For example, would you consider maize a particularly complicated organism?
Not in the sense that I just know.
We have pretty much the same transposable content as maize does in terms of percentage of genome. Okay. Maize also has about half its genome made from transposable elements.
Okay. That's ruined all my thoughts.
Transposons are always a mystery, so you never really know. But
wondering what can that potentially reveal about, perhaps the functions. I know I keep saying this word function, it's probably killing you inside every time I say it, but what does it teach us about what is the purpose of transposable elements? Why are there so many in the human genome? I just wonder maybe if it did correlate with complexity and size of genome, and if that's why there was so many in the human genome, for example, but I guess maybe not.
I mean, in terms of complexity, it can often be in particular contexts. So one weird slight mystery about transposons and in terms of complex organs is in the brain, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the brain is arguably one of the most complex organs in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a really interesting case in terms of transposable elements, because what we see is a absolute explosion in line one expression levels in the brain. Mm. And you see a surprisingly shocking amount of transpositional events. So normally you would expect that L1 transposon suddenly jumping into lots of regions in the genome would suddenly be a bad thing for the brain, because there's then the potential for genetic mutation disrupting function.
Yeah.
But there is the belief that actually the amount of insertions can lead to somatic mosaicism in the brain. And there's some belief which actually then helps in generating complexity and variation in the types of neurons which are being generated.
That's really interesting.
There's a lot of work that needs to still be done to tie that expansion of transposon expression and activity to actual functional impact.
Mm-hmm.
But especially with the expansion of things like single cell multi-omic technologies, it's hopefully something we can investigate soon.
Yeah, that would be so interesting. I'm learning so much, I didn't know any of this.
So I mean, that is a case where transposons are potentially contributing to increasing the complexity of an organ, and potentially in maybe, for example, introducing more complexity in our brain, and potentially therefore in increasing function and helping us evolve into the species we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like we say, like, I know I'm saying like, oh, maize isn't a complex, like it might not be a complex organism, but I'm thinking about complexity in terms of like, I think I'm talking about it in like a different sense. Like I would say like, for example, like primates and humans are like complex organisms, but that doesn't necessarily correlate with like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, it doesn't necessarily correlate with genome complexity, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. Does that make sense what I'm saying? Probably not.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it can really vary, and it may be, I mean, this is slightly outside my realm of expertise, but for example, the platypus, I believe, has a surprisingly small amount of transposons in its genome, despite also being relatively close to us compared to maize. Mm-hmm. So I think it may also be a case of potential chance when it comes to expansion of transposons in the genome.
Yeah, which I guess would make sense, wouldn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, what we can often consider the kind of transposon to host genome relationship is almost a host versus parasite kind of relationship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where you have an arms race where, I mean, we've talked a lot so far about the potential good things that transposons could do for a genome, mm-hmm. but we really have to acknowledge the fact that transposons can be quite damaging to the host genomes they're in.
Yeah, they absolutely. Yeah, I think that's my issue whenever I'm talking about things like this, is I always forget like the selfishness of it. And I always think like, oh, there has to be some kind of like evolutionary benefit, or like there just has to be some sort of benefit. But I guess, yeah, I just find it really hard for me to like comprehend that there might not be.
Yeah, and it's hard to really delve into those relationships because of the time scales which we're talking about.
Yeah.
No one has time for a millions year long experiment in the lab. But we can think of like, there is potential different theories as to how this relationship plays out. There's the arms race where transposons are constantly trying to evolve to promote their own self-expansion. And the host genomes are constantly trying to suppress that with things like epigenetic silencing with pi RNAs or the crabbing fingers. Mm-hmm. And then in response, transposons are evolving ways to get around that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you constantly have this backwards and forwards between the host and the transposon. And so you can end up with the transposon family escaping these repressive mechanisms, seeing a massive expansion, mm-hmm. only for then the host genome to eventually come up with a new way of suppressing that particular family, locking it down. And therefore, then the transposons change tack again, and you see these waves of transposition.
Mm-hmm.
But if, for example, if a host genome has a way of like really effectively stopping that, or if a transposon event is so deleterious, it's then self-selecting against, you potentially see situations where a species evolves to not have many transposons around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense.
But yeah, I mean, it's on the topic of transposons being able to escape host machinery. They are really interesting in how they do that sometimes. For example, in Drosophila. So probably best to frame this by talking about pi RNAs. So for transposons to be passed on to the next generation in terms of a transposition event, it ideally wants to happen in cells which will be passed down to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So this can often happen in germline or during early embryo development,
mm-hmm.
where it will then affect cells which then go on to form the germline.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we call vertical transfer. So needless to say, the germline is kind of like the front of this arms race, this war between the host and transposon. It's the time when transposons most want to be expressed, but also kind of a delicate time in our life. We want to make sure that we actually can generate healthy offspring.
Mm-hmm.
And genome stability is part of that. So we have mechanisms which are quite explicit to the germline. And one of that is like pi RNAs, which are these short RNAs and protein complexes, which are able to cleave kind of mRNAs or epigenetic silence sequences it recognizes. And so you have these small RNAs and these proteins which help silence transposons specifically within the gonads or the ovum. However, transposons in Drosophila came up with this really clever way. These I transposons start their expression not in the oocytes, but in the nurse cells for the ovaries. They generate the mRNAs and the proteins for their insertion, and then shuttle that into the oocytes. Now, although the piRNAs are expressed in the oocytes, there's not then potential time to inactivate those transposon mRNAs if they're expressed elsewhere and shuttled in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a really clever way which the transposons kind of have gone around that repressive mechanism.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And to think that this is just being derived from a DNA sequence. This isn't like a parasite or a cellular organism. It's a piece of DNA which is evolving and having these effects.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, transposable elements are way cooler than I thought they was.
I mean, this is why I got fascinated by them in my PhD. But they can also be infuriating to work with in the wet lab.
Oh, really?
I mean, by their very nature, they're incredibly repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, for example, when you are performing things like a sequencing library and you have a read which then potentially matches hundreds of sites in the genome, how are you supposed to tell site-specific kind of dynamics, especially with like epigenetic marks or things like that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was a PhD student in the lab who was working with using some kind of like Hi-C methods to try and pair hard-to-map reads to particular sites. So scientists have to come up with all these kind of complicated technologies to look at these transposons, which is also another reason why we may not know as much as we should, despite knowing so much about the genome for so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never thought about that. I feel like I'm going to like be obsessed with reading about transposable elements now. I didn't know they were this cool. I guess that I have never really like sat down to read about them. I'm gonna openly admit that I actually haven't. But they're very cool. So
if you go to like transposable element conferences, they do end up sounding like everything comes back to transposons. I don't think it does, but there are definitely some really cool stories there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So I'm just throwing in like a random. Sorry, something you'll realize, like random questions just come into my head that might just be like unrelated, but so can you like, do you know any examples of, so when we talk about like, for example, like how transposons are like, they can be like deleterious. So are there any, like, can you think of an example of like where it's perhaps linked to like a disease, like a really nice example of where it's linked to a disease, for example?
There are tons of examples. I think one of the predictions in the literature was there is like at least 120 Mendelian diseases in humans induced by transposition events. Trying to think of a particularly good example.
If you don't have one, it's fine. I just wondered
There's plenty. Just trying to think of really good examples. I mean, cancer is a big one. So cancer, for a long time, line one expression levels, the hypermethylation can be used as a prognosis for the patient outcome. And normally line one hypermethylation is indication of a pretty bad cancer.
Yeah.
And in these instances, what you can have is there's a lot of epigenetic misregulation in cancer, and this can then de-repress line one elements which were supposed to be repressed, and then that can have like a snowball effect and worsen and progress the cancer further. There was a study done by a postdoc in Miguel's lab which looked at AML cancer and identified how a group of transposable elements which were epigenetically de-repressed during the early stages of that cancer then further the oncogenic process by acting as then enhancers promoting the expression of oncogenic genes. And so these were potential endogenous retroviruses which were acting as enhancer elements during hematopoietic stem cells, which then are supposed to be fully repressed and to allow the cells to differentiate. Mm-hmm. However, in AML, these become derepressed, promote those same stem cell genes, which then just promote more oncogenic profiles in these cells and make that particular cancer even worse. So that's one case. There is also some cases where there is transmission events which can induce things like ALS. That is one where we've identified a particular transmission event into, I'm trying to remember the gene now.
How do you remember all of this?
The worst thing is this is like several years ago, so this is like memories of a memory. But yeah, I mean, there is definitely a lot to do with potential transposition events leading to actually not just transposition, but just epigenetic misregulation. There has been some instances of line 1 hypermethylation found associated with patients suffering from schizophrenia or bipolar disorder.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
So there is a potential link there. Admittedly, there needs to be more functional work into those kind of studies, but there is a lot of instances where a transposition event can lead to quite severe phenotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just ones which we know about. The result from potential transposition events, which can lead to potential like embryo lethal mutations, which we may just not see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so interesting. Coming back then to like your PhD work, because I think I kind of like diverted us away from it a little bit. Can you remind me and then also the listeners, like what was like your main, sorry, I know you've already said it, but do you mind just going over it again?
Yeah, go ahead.
What was your main like PhD topic? And then also I'm interested in like, what was your original sort of like PhD topic? Did you kind of expect your PhD project to go this way, or was it kind of like one of those accidental findings kind of thing?
So
because it seems
my PhD project really actually remained pretty unchanged throughout, which is slightly novel for a PhD project.
It's unusual, but it's to me it's like it's a really interesting like hypothesis to kind of go into a PhD with. Mm-hmm.
I mean it did really revolve around this finding of transcription factor binding motif enrichment at particular retrotransposon families.
Yeah.
And we talked about there is the enrichment for SOX2, OCT4, and NANOG binding sites in these particular rodent-specific LTR elements.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a case of this theory that they were then being co-opted by the genome to drive early embryonic stem cell early embryonic stem cell gene networks, because
mm-hmm.
they can essentially be introduced at many different sites, contain these transcription factor binding motifs, and then act as a coordinated switch to turn on multiple genes at the same time with just the same transcription factors.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a way of potentially coordinating these multiple gene networks or introducing these regulatory elements in a really quick way to mm-hmm. help speed up potentially like the evolution of that species.
Mm-hmm.
But also it wasn't just embryonic stem cells. There's also this curious oddity where you see another group of LTR elements enriched for transcription factors, which you see expressed in the trophoblast stem cells, the blastocysts.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's slightly odd because you would expect, yes, some transposons who want to be expressed within the embryonic stem cells because those are the cells which will go on to form the germline. But why would you have transposons which are enriched for transcription factors which are expressed in trophoblasts, which will never be passed down onto the progeny because the trophoblast stem cells will never go on to form the germline?
Yeah.
Which is just an interesting kind of
mm-hmm.
quandary as to why that is. And then it's just a case of whether these particular elements were just use as a genetic material to then introduce those binding motifs later. So they have weak binding motifs and were just mutated to be good enhancers for that particular context. Anyway, mm-hmm. So I'm going off a bit tangent here. So the theory was these transposons appear to be potential enhancers in these early mammalian time points and driving potentially functionally interesting gene networks for the early time point.
Yeah.
But there was a disconnect between that theory and there is no functional evidence for that.
Yeah.
So we went in, we did a lot of bioinformatic analysis. So that was a big step in the PhD, was learning bioinformatics, and we did a lot of characterizing of these elements, looking at transposon-derived enhancers versus non-transposon-derived enhancers. And we're able to identify, yes, a subgroup of these have all the characteristics and hallmarks of enhancers. They had what we might expect at enhancers, the H3K27 acetylation, H3K4 monomethylation. They indeed had binding of these transcription factors we expected them to.
Did you have to like experimentally like validate that? Did you have to kind of check like, okay, there are like binding motifs, but are transcription factors actually binding here?
That's the thing. And actually, we found a lot of disconnect between motif presence and actual binding of the transcription factors.
Yeah.
Okay. Which in itself is still a question I'm constantly worried about is, yes, I can find motifs in the enhancer groups I'm looking at, but is it actually there? And so we definitely found a lot of cases where transposons appear to have all the hallmarks of potentially being an enhancer, but just weren't. We never really investigated that further, but what we did see is, yeah, there was this subgroup which really looked like enhancers, and the rest of the PhD was developing CRISPR technologies to really see if they walked the walk. And so we did some very old school kind of genetics, which is just break it and see what happens. And so we did some genetic excisions of individual retroelements in mouse embryonic stem cells and in trophoblast stem cells, and then seeing if we saw impacts on the associated gene expression. And then we also did some coordinated class-wide CRISPR silencing, so trying to silence hundreds of transposable enhancers at the same time and seeing if that also could pick out any good indicators for these enhancers acting as enhancers. We identified a good number of these transposable elements which functionally were helping upregulate the nearby gene expression or genes which we found to be interacting by high C data.
Can I interrupt and ask a question just before I forget to ask it? You mentioned like how you were looking at like, I forgot the terms that you were using, but like trans, like, so when you're looking at like transposable elements that are acting as enhancers, and then I think you said something along the lines of like normal enhancers or something like that.
Yeah, so we called non-transposon derived enhancers.
That's it.
Enhancers which looked and seemed to be behaving like enhancers in the embryonic stem cells.
And are these is there a known database for like
There are now many regulatory kind of build sets. For this, we kind of made our own enhancer calling, looking at distal H3K27 acetylation peaks, as well as transcription factor binding.
Did you see, so what were like the differences between those two groups then? Were there any differences between them?
There actually was some interesting differences, mostly in terms of specificity. So the transposon-derived enhancers appear to be a lot more specific to the embryonic stem cells, whereas non-transposon-derived enhancers appear to be active in quite a few different time points and in tissue contexts, as well as also the expression of the associated genes appeared to be less specific, whereas the transposon-derived enhancers appear to be driving genes which were expressing in just the embryonic stem cells.
So yeah, that's really interesting then, isn't it?
It's potentially a case of the transposon enhancers were potentially evolutionary younger enhancers, where they're being inserted into a gene which is not necessarily normally upregulated but will become upregulated now it has this enhancer. And so the expression of that gene is maybe more tightly linked to that transposon. But this was just a wild theory. We never really managed to investigate that.
So I'm going to answer like a further question on this thing, even though you just said that. But like, is anything known about like, so what sort of like triggers these enhancers to start working at particular times? So for example, you've mentioned like their, I guess, is activation the right word? I don't know, like their activity across like time points. Is anything known about like what actually triggers them to start acting at a particular time? Or is that more to do with just like, I don't know,
there appears to be potentially two reasons for this. One, which is they have
stupid questions.
No, there's no stupid questions. So one is the combination of transcription factor binding motifs we saw there. Mm-hmm. The motif combination is potentially just a combination of transcription factors which are only expressed in that particular context.
Right. Yeah. Okay. It was a stupid question. Yeah.
But there is also some really interesting things going on a global epigenetics level. During this early development, mm-hmm. where you're seeing global waves of hypomethylation, which potentially helps these particular transposon elements, which, I mean, a lot of DNA methylation is targeted to transposons.
Yep.
And potentially this is just a good time point where they're able to escape that DNA methylation, enhancers, whereas in normal contexts, they are potentially quite repressed by that targeted methylation to transposable mm-hmm. elements.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is really obvious now you've said it.
So it may just be the merging of those two particular concepts.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, we can talk about some of the interesting findings from the cases we did see. So there's a really interesting story in one of the actual transposon enhancers we found, which was really strong in its evidence of acting as an enhancer. And it was associated with this gene called TDRD12, which interestingly plays a part in this piRNA pathway, which is functioning to inhibit transposons. So you have this transposon turning on a gene, which will then potentially inhibit transposon activity in the testes. And so you had a transposon almost working for the other team, helping the host genome inhibit other transposons. So you could always think about it as the host genome hiring a mole agent to turn against its friends and help turn these transposons off.
Yeah, that's super interesting. My question has literally just come back to me.
Mm-hmm.
I was gonna ask, so for example, this time point where these like transposable, I keep forgetting what terms you're using, sorry. So like the transposon specific enhancers, that is not the term you use, but you know what I'm saying. Transposon derived enhancers. I feel like I need to write that down so I don't forget. So the point at which like the transposon derived enhancers activity is high at the specific time point in development, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you compare against like just non-transposon derived enhancer activity? So is it a case of like just in general, like anything that looks like enhancer is like the activity is going to be high, or is it just the transposon derived enhancer activity is high? Is that something that you looked at, or if not, like what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, both transposon derived enhancers and non-transposon derived enhancers appear to become just as good as an enhancer as each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to like discuss as well in terms of level of functionality of an enhancer,
mm-hmm.
Especially when you are looking at things like just the epigenetic signature of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's something which I don't think the field has a really good grasp of, is like how much H3K trace amino acetylation is required to be a good functional enhancer.
Right, yeah.
In like CHIP-seq data sets.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, in reality, on an individual strand of DNA, you have H3K trace amino acetylation or you don't. Mm-hmm. And really that level is then dependent on how often that happens within the population.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we didn't necessarily see any differences in the functionality of those, but we didn't also look too hard at it either. Mm-hmm. Now, what we didn't do, for example, is start removing non-TE derived enhancers and see if they prove to be at the same rate functional enhancers as transposon derived enhancers. We didn't know, for example, if there's more false friends in transposon mm-hmm. enhancers
or
non-transposon enhancers.
Yeah.
Is there other regions of DNA which also recruit epigenetic signatures similar to enhancer but don't act like enhancer?
Because
you can see reasons why that would happen in transposons, because the whole evolutionary drive is to recruit active epigenetic signatures. However, there's not necessarily the same imperative for non-transposon derived sequences.
That makes sense.
So that would have been a really interesting question to follow up on.
Yeah, it would be, definitely. So you've mentioned a couple of times, did you actually knock out, for example, like particular enhancers? Like, is that something that you did?
We induced CRISPR double strand breaks either side of a transposon and induced around a KB worth of excision from the genome. So just completely removed the sequence. And that way we hopefully removed any enhancer effect that sequence had.
And then so from there, you then look at like how that affects gene expression, right?
Yes.
And so how do you know then, like, how did you know what genes to look at? Did you look at like the nearest genes, or you had to then incorporate like looking at chromatin looping, or?
So we did both, really. Thankfully had a great data set produced by Stefan Schoenfelder at the time for chromatin confirmation in both mouse ES and trophoblast stem cells. And so we used that to try and identify which genes were expected, but also we looked at any genes in a nearby region.
Yeah.
And so for this particular enhancer, so say TDID12, we found pretty much every gene we saw it potentially interacting with had been knocked down. And that is actually interesting, with now we are starting to understand how enhancers can potentially form enhancer hubs, where a single enhancer is potentially interacting with multiple promoters. Or multiple enhancers are interacting with a single promoter. This might be a case of where just a single enhancer is interacting with multiple promoters. We use the combination of both proximity modeling and HiSeq to try and infer which promoters they were potentially interacting with. And actually, in that case, we were quite relieved, because when you induce double strand breaks in the genome, you can potentially really interfere with the chromatin state of that DNA region. You potentially introduce repressive chromatin or lose the active H3K27 acetylation at a nearby promoter. And a lot of these enhancers we were cutting out were quite close to promoters. Some transposons are predisposed to target just the upstream region of the promoter for a gene. It's one of the mechanisms we're trying to make sure that they are introducing open chromatin and in a region which is transcriptionally permissive. So we were always worried about whether we were potentially seeing effects of that interfering with chromatin states. So when we did the CRISPR-I experiment, where we're using dCas9 conjugated to a CRAB domain, we were quite happy to see that, we were able to interfere some of the same sites, not just by cutting out, but also by general epigenetic silencing of the region. So we were sure that hopefully it wasn't just bleed over, there is different kind of regions, bleed out effects of those two different approaches. But also where we had cut out that TID nearby retrotransposon enhancer, we were seeing repression at lots of different far away genes as well. And so we knew it wasn't just a case of removing that region led to a downstream effect of heterochromatin being introduced at nearby promoters.
It's something I've not thought about. Did you knock out, like, so when you did this experiment, did you, like, for example, did you disrupt like all of them at once, or was you doing it kind of like individually?
We did with the CRISPR excisions, that was individually. We typically didn't have the ability to target everything with CRISPR silencing either. So when I say the repeat sequences, even then, these relatively new transposons are mutated to the point where a single CRISPR guide won't hit every single element in that family. There are mutations across it. And so we used about four guides in combination to try and target quite a high number of the family. But even then, with four of them, we weren't able to hit everything. So ideally you would be able to target absolutely everything, but you can't necessarily stop them as acting as enhancers without disrupting the same transcription factor network, which the embryonic stem cells need. And also it's a case of there is limits to how many guide RNAs you can really introduce into a system, and also how many breaks you can induce. I mean, talk about transposon-derived genomic instability. If you start introducing hundreds of different double-strand breaks simultaneously in the genome, the cell's not going to like that.
Yeah.
But that being said, there have been studies which kind of hit tens of transposable elements with just a couple of guides and see like inactivation of them. But that's more for knocking out their ability to transpose. So they target like the coding proteins.
I suppose it makes, like, personally, I feel like it makes more sense anyway to just like target them individually, right?
Yeah, it does mean slightly more work though.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But so, I mean, now there's like single cell screening approaches. So things like CropSeq, which is a way which you can read both the guide sequence from the mRNA and then also do your experiment. So you can do like a CRISPR silencing or CRISPR activation in a single cell, have an idea which guide RNA was in that cell, as well as also its transcriptional output. You can potentially screen then loads of different guide RNAs within just a small amount of cells. You don't have to have an individual plate per guide and transfect them individually. So these technologies, they're constantly developing. And like I did my PhD like 3 or 4 years ago. And so it's a case of, now have we done that experiment, we could potentially use those to really high throughput and test loads of different kind of individual sites. But again, like I said, repeat sequences, they're a pain to work with. It's hard to get guides which are only going to hit a single element. And this was actually a lot of the issue with the work in my PhD, was trying to develop guide RNA sequences which will hit the family you're interested in and not nearby associated families which have similar sequences. And so, yeah, we kind of developed a software tool for designing those guide RNAs. And just as I finished my PhD, someone came up with a tool and published it, which was a much better tool than the one I made.
Oh, no.
So it's this case of, where was this tool 4 years ago when I needed it?
Yeah, yeah. You might have just touched on a question that I've just wrote down, which is when you were looking at like their like effects with regards to like gene expression. Did you see anything, like, did you perhaps look at how maybe different families had different effects?
So it appeared to be that different families had been recruited for active enhancers in different contexts. There was the LTR13D5 and RLTR9 families, which are just like names given to the individual families we can identify as being separate from one another. And there was a different subgroups of RLTR elements which were appeared to be active enhancers in just the trophoblasts themselves. But we didn't see intermingling between those groups. So we didn't see an enhancer group acting as an enhancer in both contexts. It was one or the other. So we really did see potential like a similar approach being used for different transposable families, but for driving expression of gene networks in different contexts. So it's almost like a concurrent evolution. There's a particular term for it. I'm blanking on what it is.
Don't ask me.
Where two processes evolve simultaneously, but not necessarily dependent on one another.
I wish I could help you here, Chris, but...
Yeah, I was really hoping you would.
But yeah,
it looks like this approach was being repeated in different contexts to achieve different things from different transposable families. And so this maybe is a process which the host genome has done on a regular basis. It's something which is capable of doing.
Yeah.
Now, I have also read a really interesting theory where actually this isn't necessarily a case of the host genome co-opting and taking advantage of transposons, but actually transposons are getting host genomes addicted to using this as the process of introducing new enhancers. Transposons are providing an easy way to introduce enhancers. And so host genomes are using that and then removing that process of producing its own enhancers.
That's really interesting.
So that is a really interesting theory. Admittedly, I don't know too much about it, but that's a really cool way of thinking about it.
Yeah, no, that is really, really cool. Very interesting. What would you say are like your, if you had to pick like your favorite finding from your PhD? Like, what was like the one thing during this work that you were like, oh my God, that is so cool? Like, what is it?
Wow.
Because I feel like it's all really, really cool. Like, if I was you, I just like everything would have just excited me so much. So I'm just
this is a problem with PhDs. You have to somewhat narrow focus.
Yeah.
But it's a case of sometimes in science, luck can be a big factor.
Yeah, definitely. I don't understand why people say that it's not, because I think it definitely is. So I agree with that, to be honest.
And so, like,
I mean, it's not just luck. It's worth saying that it's not just luck.
It's not just luck. There's work as well, but it is a case of finding this particular enhancer, this TDRD12 associated enhancer transposon. Mm-hmm. When we cut that out, we saw the biggest effect we had ever seen in these cell lines for an enhancer when we knocked it out.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one enhancer out of several hundred.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we obviously were limited as to which ones we could pick. We tried picking the best candidates, but we saw this big impact of like, okay, it's true. Some of these are acting as functional enhancers.
Yeah.
And so that was like one of the biggest kind of findings at the time, because we had at that point no other working ones.
Mm-hmm.
All the other ones we'd investigated at that point had led to being minimal or no impact.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we finally got the multiplex CRISPR-I to work, where we managed to hit multiple transposons and we saw exactly the same one come out again,
mm-hmm.
we're like, okay,
yeah,
we got lucky, because we found one of the most striking examples by luck when we started picking our candidate sites. So I guess in retrospect, that felt like one of the coolest results, because we saw this big impact, which we would have not seen if we were looking elsewhere.
Yeah. Was that like also a moment where you was like, kind of like doubted it for a second?
There was definitely a period. And there is, obviously we did lots of repeats. We wanted to test multiple lines. But the fact that we approached this enhancer in two different methodologies and found the same result was the most comforting result we could have seen.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely.
And like, I know talking about the PhD work in retrospect makes it sound like everything was rosy and we found all these exciting things. But a lot of these results kind of came in the last few months of the PhD.
Yeah. Okay. That brings me so much like comfort to hear you say that, because I've literally got a couple months left.
It was a case of setting up a lot of groundwork for those final experiments, which showed a lot of really interesting and cool biology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I think it's easy for, like, I think just in general, like after a PhD, everything sounds, you know, I was talking with Bradley the other day. So I did a presentation at the Epi Hub the other day, and it was by far the worst presentation. Like, it wasn't even that bad, but I really, really enjoy like public speaking, and I really enjoy giving talks because I put a lot of time into my talks. So afterwards, I always feel quite good about them, like, you know, in a way. But I've spent the last couple of months presenting like this particular paper that has like been submitted, like, so it's a really nice like finished story, you know, and mm-hmm. like you kind of like get used to, like I got used to presenting this really nice, well-formulated story. And then I went on to presenting this like project that I'm halfway through, it's halfway done. And it was all a mess. And it kind of gave me that like I met Radio said to me, like, you know, like, of course, all the other presentations are going to feel better, like they're all going to make more sense kind of thing. And I feel like that's quite similar with the PhD. When you hear someone talk about their PhD after, you know, it's done, it all does sound just like nice, but you forget that there was so much time like during the PhD when it was all just a mess and they were just trying mm-hmm. to make sense of everything, and you know.
So yeah, to all those PhD students who are they're struggling thinking, oh, why does my story not line up with like how other people's stories have turned out?
Absolutely.
No PhD is the same.
Yeah, exactly.
None of have the same timeline. And there is a case of it's about drawing a through line at the end, which makes it sound really neat. But there is a lot of dead ends, a lot of things which could have been followed up. Mm. And that in itself is kind of good training for being a scientist as like a postdoc.
Yeah,
because you have to be able to navigate that. You are doing lots of things at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and then trying to pick the ones which actually will have that line through that story, and potentially that you follow the data mostly,
mm-hmm.
and you end up with hopefully a nice story at the end.
Yes. I think everyone does. And I mean, that's what your supervisors are there for at the end of the day. Like, they're there to make sure that you do end up with a nice story, you know, like they stop you from going down avenues that are probably not, you know, not worth your time and things. Like, there's been some things that I've tried to do where Leo Radio said to me, like, nope, go and do this instead. And that's what they're there for. So everyone will get to the end point where they have a nice thesis and a nice story. And we'll all be like Chris one day.
The main thing is more of the skills you learn as your PhD, yeah, not necessarily the story you end up with.
Yeah, definitely.
I just want to stress that, because sometimes you'll come at the end of the PhD and you won't have much successful data at all.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, unfortunately, that is the nature.
True. Yeah, very true.
So it is a case of the skills you build up and mm-hmm. how you think about your science and how you discuss your science are all
but this is the thing. I think then it comes to the point, like, it comes to the question of, like, even though you might have, you know, like, I'm doing quotation marks, no one can see me, but rubbish data, but I don't think any data is rubbish. It's, you can tell the story in a rubbish way, but it doesn't, do you know what I mean? Like, I think it very much comes down to how you write your thesis and how you tell that story. Just because your data is insignificant or you didn't find what you were hoping for, it doesn't mean that you can't formulate a nice story.
Yeah, and sometimes negative data is still important for the field to have. And it's something
which, very important, yeah,
hopefully, absolutely, is starting to be more rewarded because yeah, things like, for example, DORA, not to get on a soapbox for a minute, but things like the DORA principles, where we're trying to...
I don't know what this is, but okay.
The DORA principles are a agreement made by a number of institutions now, which are trying to promote positive research outputs and not just rewarding significant data or high impact paper publications. And it's a case of trying to help scientists who are potentially doing fundamental groundwork in generating atlases or research output, which don't necessarily lead to high impact papers, but are necessary for the field to have. And it's trying to maybe change how we do science as a community.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just necessarily about that Nature paper. It's about the quality of the research as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't know about this.
I'd look it up. I highly recommend it.
I will do.
Hopefully a sign of good things in the field.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I've probably taken up a lot of your time. So I'll finish up with two last questions that I have.
Yeah.
The first one being, can you maybe talk a little bit about, like, what you're doing now? What are the next steps? Like, where are you going?
I'd love to talk about the stuff I'm doing now because I'm excited about it. So I'm currently looking at lineage priming. So the Wolf Lab are experts in developing these single-cell multiomic technologies. And they had applied single-cell multiomics, by the way, just for anyone who isn't aware, as probably most people, because I wasn't even aware of it until I really started looking at that lab, is where you can take a single cell and get multiple levels of information from it, getting transcriptional data, DNA methylation data, and DNA accessibility data, all from the single cell, from the same cell.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get an idea of not only its expression, but also its epigenetic state at the same time. And so you can better kind of link epigenetic states of regulatory elements, for example, with the transcriptional output.
Mm-hmm.
And it also allows you, for example, using single cell technologies to look at tissues where there's only a very small amount in of that particular sample. And so applying this all to mouse embryo, we're able to identify that in the mouse epiblast, the ectodermal enhancers, which will be turned on at like E7.5 when the germ layers are established, those enhancers were being pre-activated ahead of time. So like the mouse epiblast was already thinking about become ectodermal cells. Mm-hmm. And we can think of this as almost like a default lineage for the epiblast to take. We're having to take a push to one side to become either mesoderm or endoderm.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started, I also wanted to look at seeing if such a process of lineage priming was found in humans as well. And indeed, we're able to identify a number of enhancer elements which were being pre-activated ahead of time. But actually, we're also starting to show some really interesting data suggesting that it's not just those early germ layer decisions, but also some enhancer elements, which are only activated quite considerably later in development, looking at like the earlier stages of the brain. If you look at those enhancers, which are only turned on at that point, we're finding subsets of enhancers which are pre-activated as early as the epiblast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's seeing that the really early embryo is kind of drawing out all these blueprints for the tissues it needs to make and mm-hmm. preparing those regulatory networks for activation ahead of time. And that's potentially helping it make these really quick and snappy, snell-fit decisions. Mm-hmm. And quite interestingly, we're seeing that this program of epigenetic priming of enhancer elements is intrinsically linked with developmental gene networks. So we're seeing that it's the really functionally important enhancers which are the ones undergoing this epigenetic priming. And it's a way of potentially also the genome making sure that those enhancers are activated when they're needed.
So cool. Really, really, really cool. And you like talked a lot about this at the conference, didn't you?
Yeah, so if anyone wants to know more, they're more than welcome to look up the recordings, or are they down now?
The recordings are, yeah, they're up. They're all there. So highly recommend that you go and check it out, because it made me grab Chris for the podcast. So
whether you regret that now is a different matter.
Oh, absolutely not. Of course I don't. I've learned so much like interesting stuff. I love transposable elements now. So there we go.
they're fascinating and mysterious at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. I remember I don't know if like, have you ever read the book by Nessa Carey, Epigenetics Revolution?
I have not, unfortunately.
Oh my gosh. I feel like everyone needs to just read this book because it's so good. So she's got two books, Epigenetics Revolution, and then also another book called Junk DNA. And mm-hmm. I absolutely loved Epigenetics Revolution. And I started reading it when I was like in sixth form. And of course I didn't understand any of it, absolutely none of it. But I was like, this is so, so cool. Really, like really, really exciting, because I'm an identical twin. So the first time I'd like heard about epigenetics and like mm-hmm. properly read about it, I was like, this is so, so cool. And anyway, so she brought out this other book called Junk DNA, which like talks a lot about obviously junk DNA. And it's really, really interesting. And I started reading it and I never really like finished it. And obviously it's like, you know, all the basics are not like the really, it is interesting, but not like the complex interest and stuff that you spoke about. But ever since I've always been like, I know I need to read more about all of this stuff, but I just like haven't had the chance. But I'm glad that you like, yeah, I'm glad I've got you on and I learned a lot of like interesting stuff. So, I mean, yeah, your research now sounds really, really cool. So how much longer have you got left of your postdoc? And
So I'm leaving the BI to join Altos sometime later this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't have much time left. So yeah, it's a case of what I can fit in that time.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
We have some interesting things we're trying. So we want to work on some single locus proteomics approaches
mm-hmm.
to identify all the factors which we think are interacting with these primed enhancers, helping establish that primed state, as mm-hmm. well as also what holds them in this primed state for these considerably long times during development.
Mm-hmm.
We also have, again, some going back to some old school genetic approaches, and we want to start swapping things around in the genome, placing primed enhancer sequences into non-primed loci and seeing whether there is the sequence content or the sequence context which makes you a primed enhancer.
Yep.
And so that's some experiments I can fit in the meantime.
Yeah. No, that sounds amazing. I'm excited to like hear, well, hopefully we'll get to hear more about like all of your research and everything. Hopefully. I'm confident that you'll fit in as much as you possibly can in that time.
I'm sure I will.
You definitely will. So yeah, amazing. And then the last question, I guess, is if anyone sort of like wants to follow you on social media, if they want to, you know, follow your research or anything, do you have like Twitter or anything?
I unfortunately am the world's worst tweeter. I have all of one tweet, I think.
Oh.
But I highly recommend following the Right Lab Twitter page. Yep. They're a lot more active. We put out journal club summaries, which obviously we take part in as a whole lab putting together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And often our research, including mine, is advertised there most. Mm-hmm. But if anyone does want to get in contact, they are welcome to message me through Twitter at C_D_Todd.
Mm-hmm.
Or alternatively to email me at chris.todd@babraham.ac.uk.
Amazing. Perfect. Thank you. I'll put them in the description. And yeah, thank you so much for talking to me. I appreciate it. I had so much fun.
It's been a pleasure.
It was a really good episode to like restart my podcast year with, because like I said, I literally haven't filmed an episode for a couple of months. And I weirdly got like really like, oh, like I just got really funny about it. But no, I feel like this has reminded me how much I love doing this. So I had a great time. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation and I learned a lot. So thank you.
Hopefully I sparked some interest in transposons and hopefully some budding transposon researchers in the future.
Yes, you definitely sparked the interest in me at least. And I'm sure other people. So yeah, I appreciate it. I appreciate your time. And yeah, thank you again. No worries. Thank you for joining me for this episode. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast platform. And you can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram. The handle on both of those is @TheGenomicsLab. And be sure to check out all of our other fun episodes. We have tons of topics ranging from DNA nanotechnology to epigenetics, spatial transcriptomics. I've covered a lot of it on this show, so if you want to hear about it, I've probably done so. If not, if there's a topic that I haven't covered that you want to hear about, send me a message on Twitter or Instagram and I will get it covered for you. So thanks again for listening. And yeah, don't forget to subscribe or follow the show on wherever you're listening to us from.